So as we see this genocidal game play itself out ruthlessly over and over again, let's now put this in a certain context. And let's hear from the well-known Negro Democrat, Jesse Jackson. Jesse Jackson's wife, Jacqueline, is supporting Hillary. Jesse is supporting Obama with one of his sons, I believe. Let's hear Jackson talk about what the quote-unquote issues are surrounding Obama. Big this.
Issue now is if this multiracial, multicultural coalition continues to grow, if young people move away from so much self-destruction and self-gratification to a public policy involvement, that is the ultimate victory for America. I mean, after all, who is to fight the fight to end the war except young people in the streets of America? They choose those streets. Who is to fight for increasing Pell Grants? And who's to fight to stop the drug consumption addiction we have, which drives the drug supply trade in the world? When young America changes its mind and its appetite and its values, it has the power to change the world. An African American winning Iowa will fight Iowans mature enough in their thinking to choose message and relationships over race is a big deal. Because there were those who would say don't go to Iowa, New Hampshire, because they're not representative of the multicultural states. But so that said a lot to me about the maturing of America.
This is some sick stuff. As I went over before, you know, the whole, you know, modified Negro, I won't deal with that aspect about now, because we know there's no real maturing of America when you have the masses participating in what basically is a fraud, and it's a setup, a diversion. But on top of that, when you hear Jackson yap about how, as this coalition, this multiracial coalition continues to grow, and you know, young people stop in this self-gratification. I mean, this is sickening, because here you have, we just went over the issue of Saul, Anthony Lake, Brzezinski, all these people who are down with Obama, advisors to him and stuff, and they are all strategists of the imperial order, and there is no appetite. There's no bottom to their incessant appetite. They are the gratification, the material consumption, the greediness that they represent surpasses anything on the planet. These corporate overlords, Mickey Mouse. Look, you have women working for Nestle's chocolate, making 10 cents an hour. And all Aristide was trying to do was raise the minimum wage up, or create a minimum wage and make it somewhat a livable wage. But that was too much for them. Yet, this type of greed and instant gratification for the by the imperial order is something that Jesse Jackson doesn't address, in part because he himself is aligned with it, along with Obama, and they both support the gratification and the greed of the imperial order by being Democrats. Jackson then goes on to say that who's to fight to end the war? Young people. Yet, when you have those of us who are confused by design on how the war is being fought and projected, when you have those of us who are being misled by Democrats intentionally on the definition of combat troops, as I went over in the slave show Snow Job, So when they talk about bringing combat troops home, they're not talking about bringing all these GIs home. First of all, a mercenary is not considered a combat troop. A person fighting Al-Qaeda, a GI fighting Al-Qaeda is not a combat troop. A GI protecting those who are in the... who is protecting an imperial ambassador is not considered a combat troop. And a GI who is training Iraqis in Iraq is not considered a combat troop. So the definition of a combat troop is quite different than what most people imagine it to be. It's just an optical illusion. But this optical illusion has intentionally been created by the Democrats and Republicans, and it is intentionally facilitated by the corporate media establishment, which is tied within the whole corporate imperial construct and is essential within the head-fixing game. And it's essential for Jackson to play the art of illusion in the way that he is doing. And that's what Jackson, in essence, wants for the masses. Because he is. He wants you to be complicit in the imperial agenda. And the way to do that is by, among other things, to vote for one of these imperial administrators or another, a Democrat or a Republican. Now, you also heard Jackson say, you know, when people change their mind and appetite, that's when we have the power to change the world. Well, in reality, we can't change the world through a misunderstanding of what the Democrats and the Republicans are all about and whose interests they serve. Jackson's job is basically to help keep the black masses and the masses in general entrapped in the politics of optical and physical illusion. And to show you how cynical this Negro is, an article January 26, 2005 came out called Jim Crow Returns to the Voting Booth. And it is titled also, Does America Have Apartheid Vote Counting System? And some of the article goes like this. The inaugural confetti has been swept away, and with it, the last quarrel over who really won the presidential election. But there is still unfinished business that can't be swept away. And after taking his oath, the president called for a concerted effort to promote democracy, quote unquote. The president should begin with the United States. More than 133,000 votes remain uncounted in Ohio, more than G.W. Bush's supposed margin of victory. In New Mexico, the uncounted vote totals at least three times the presidential plurality, and so on in other states. The challenge to the vote count is over, but the matter of how the United States counts votes or fails to count them remains. The ballots left uncounted and that will never be counted are so-called spoiled or rejected ballots. Votes cast by citizens but never tallied. This is the dark little secret of U.S. democracy. Nationwide, in our presidential election, about 2 million votes are cast and never counted, most spoiled because they cannot be read by the tallying machines. Not everyone's vote spoils equally. Cleveland State's University professor Mark Salling analyzed ballots thrown into Ohio's electoral garbage can. Salling found that overwhelmingly, the void votes come from African-American precincts. This racial bend in vote spoilage is not unique to Ohio. A U.S. Civil Rights Commission investigation concluded that of nearly 180,000 votes discarded in Florida in the 2000 election as unreadable, a shocking 54% were cast by black voters. Though they make up only a tenth of the electorate, in Florida, an African American is 900% more likely to have his or her vote invalidated by a white voter. In New Mexico, a Hispanic voter is 500% more likely than a white voter to have his or her ballot lost to spoilers. Unfortunately, Florida and New Mexico are typical. Nationwide, data gathered by Harvard Law School Civil Rights Project indicated that of the 2 million ballots spoiled in a typically presidential election, about half are cast by minority voters. Now, let me stop right there for a sec. Because what's kind of sickening about this, and it goes further into, you know, this scam, is that this one was selected as one of the most censored stories of that particular year. So it won, an award for being one of the most important but censored stories. What's fascinating is that the article was written by Greg Polis and Jesse Jackson. So here you have a situation where Jesse Jackson knows firsthand that even those who are voting, playing the game he wants, that there's a scam going on. And still today, the issues that Jackson and Polis raised have not been addressed. But Jackson ignores all of this in the so-called exuberance of the Negro president. It's a game, and it's a sick game. So when you hear Jackson talk about the whites of Iowa were mature enough to choose message over race, what is really Obama's message when he has Anthony Lake, Brzezinski, and others, imperial henchmen, as his advisors, and who are going to be part, most likely, of his imperial structure order? This is how they set things up. What does it mean when Obama says he will add 100,000 new imperial troops in his permanent war stage? What does it mean when Obama says there's no black America, no white America, no Latin America, only a United States of America, when we have a rich America that's getting richer and richer, and a poor America that's getting poorer and poorer, and one of the ways and key components of this is how they play out the racial game. But for Obama, he plays the games that we should move beyond it. It's post-racial, which is swallowed up by a gumpified mass in this Negro Camelot 2.0 game. And for those who have faced Obama and company on even strategic levels within the Democratic Party, they know themselves that the true face of Obama and his projection is quite different than what many people want to believe. Segalus vs. the Machine, March 3rd, 2006, by Cindy Sheehan. Cindy goes, quote, "I am beginning to wonder What is it that such Democrats like Rahm Emanuel, Chuck Schumer, and Nancy Pelosi are protecting in Iraq? What is it that they have at stake in keeping the occupation of Iraq going? Their constituents in every case are solidly anti-war and anti-Bush. They all come from the bluest of states and or districts. Yet when faced with the chance to defend and promote anti-war candidates who agree with the majority of Americans that it's time to get out of Iraq this year, they go into overdrive to try to destroy their candidacies. Take the case of Christina Silivis. Silivis opposes the war before it started. She supports single-payer health care and a strong transition to renewable energy. She's pro-choice and anti-CAFTA, and she has a strong grassroots following in her district. In short, Christine Sigis is exactly the kind of candidate that the Democratic Party needs, or claims they need or want. That's me. Continuing. On top of that, in 2004, Christina took on the thankless task of running against arch-conservative Henry Hyde, a Republican from Illinois. You remember Henry Hyde, the man whose name is on key right to life, the man who led the impeachment against Bill Clinton, the man who now chairs the International Relations Committee in the House and routinely buries anti-war Democrats' attempts to investigate the lie that took us into the war in Iraq, that took Casey. Surprisingly, Christina racked up 44% against Hyde, despite being outspent 4-1. She immediately announced that she would run again, and faced with her continuing strong grassroots opposition, Hyde decided to retire. What was her reward for this service? Not an infusion of money to help her win an open seat against a former Tom DeLay aide. No. Instead, DCCC head Rahm Emanuel, helped out and found a candidate to run against her. A woman who did not even live in the district. Then led by Emanuel, almost all prominent Democrats in the country, John Kerry, Hillary Clinton, Nancy Pelosi, and yes, y'all, Barack Obama, and others have weighed in on behalf of Sigis' opponent. In other words, they're supporting her opponent. The new candidate deserves our praise for her service. Like my son, she served her country and paid a high price for her service, and for that I applaud her. Tammy Duckworth has served her country honorably in and out of the military and seems to be a good person. But here is her position on Iraq, straight from the Republican talking points. Quote, "The fact is that we are in Iraq right now and we can't simply pull up stakes and create a security vacuum, unquote. Duckworth is not a backer of setting a timetable in the Iraq war and getting out. And her lead sponsor is Emanuel, the man who infamously said, when asked about Murtha's effort to stop the war, that, quote, at the right time, we will have a position, unquote. Christine Sigis is a true progressive on the issues. And here is her position on the illegal and immoral occupation of Iraq. Quote, the war in Iraq has taken the lives of more than 2,000 American men and women and killed and injured tens of thousands of innocent Iraqis. More than $200 billion tax dollars have been poured into the effort. Our credibility in the eyes of the world has been severely damaged. The Bush administration's conduct in starting and executing this conflict has been a disaster from the very earliest stages. She ends up going on, I'm going to stop right there, talking about how Al-Qaeda, quote, had no link to Iraq before our invasion. Now it is a breeding ground for hatred and terror and an idea recruiting pool for Al-Qaeda and other terrorist networks. Actually, Al-Qaeda is part of the military imperial apparatus. But my whole point is here's someone who was in the Democratic Party, who was trying to counter Bush administrative imperial policies, and who was supported by the masses And what was the leadership in the Democrats' response, Hillary's response, Barack's response, Emmanuel's response? To run someone against her who was going to be more compliant to the imperial projection. That right there shows that they are running a scam. This is an imperial agenda that they know that they are on. A permanent war stage that they know that they are on. And when other candidates come up, even within their own party, they will discipline them to keep this genocidal process going on. So when you hear Hillary talk about on the possibility of the U.S. empire attacking Iran, saying that, quote, no option can be taken off the table. And when you hear Barack say that, quote, the Iranian government is a threat to us all, and we should take no option, including military action, off the table. As I've outlined in other slave shows, the imperial progression of this permanent war stage is on track. Whether it comes out of the behind of Barack or Hillary, this is the reality that we are living in. And when you hear a shyster like Jackson help project this whole post-racial rhetoric, it helps facilitate many white people who refer to Obama, and when they talk about Obama, as seeing him not as a person of color, but just a man who is like them, meaning white.
Hello.
And that they applaud him for not focusing in on racial issues in this post-racial, modified, melodified environment. And that part of the successfulness of Obama is that he doesn't deal with the color line issues. And for that, he is rewarded for his successful actions and behavior. But in reality, in not dealing with the color line, he is intentionally avoiding the class line. And he is playing the white masses in general through that process, as he willingly allows them to jump down that rabbit hole. Thus, Obama becomes nothing more than a high-tech, well-spoken servant, an administrator for the ruling order. It also brings about the fact that what it means to be qualified. When someone is qualified, it means that you are playing the role that you are supposed to play for the not only the larger white masses that you don't want to offend with blackness, but you play the proper qualified role. And you make it clear to the rulers your imperial agenda and intentions in helping them maintain their economic domination that is tied to the economy and social politics of whiteness. And that, as the modified, melodified Negro, you will serve those interests obediently. In essence, Barack is like the modern-day, unfunny court jester of black representative politics. This, for many Americans, represents a new form of Negro Camelot. He represents, for them, the mulatto savior, But the reality is, he and others are leading the world to imperial hell. Now let's see how this is playing out in Jackson's maturing concept of America's rhetoric. And Dyson, Michael Eric Dyson, is jabbering about all this post-racial nonsense. Here's Bill Bennett, former drug czar and educational secretary, chiming in after Obama's victory in Iowa.
Well, I think it's and again, a wonder of America here. A remarkable breakthrough this year, as another group said. 97%, in fact, Iowa, rural, white, farming state. Barack Hussein Obama, a black man, wins this with the Democrats. I have been watching him. I watched him on Meet the Press. I watched him on your show. I watched him on all the CNN shows. He never brings race into it. He never plays the race card. Talk about the black community. He has taught the black community, you don't have to act like Jesse Jackson. You don't have to act like Al Sharpton. You can talk about the issues. Great dignity, and this is a breakthrough.
I know the national media is, you know, they talk a lot about the loss of revenue or the...
So, here you have a situation where you have this clown, Bill Bennett, talking about this is a wonder of America. A remarkable breakthrough. Now, what kind of breakthrough does it represent when, at the end of the day, if you are voting for Barack, Hillary, or McCain, or whoever, you are still complicit in serving an imperial agenda? It's this shuffling of the decks. But then, of course, Bill Bennett states that Barack never brings race into it. He never plays the race card. Well, in actuality, Barack is playing the race card, quote unquote. It's the one being dealt out by much of white America. It's the colorblind card, the race neutral card, the mulatto savior card, the Negro Camelot card. That is one that avoids the racial class issues. But according to Bennett, if you bring race into the equation at all, you're playing the race card. Well, at least if you're black and you do it. Now, this shows how things are being flipped and manipulated intentionally on your head. As I stated before, Barack just represents the modern day Negro professional class of politics. And within that projection, he also represents the illusion of change. Now, when you hear Bennett say that Barack has taught the black community that don't act like Jesse Jackson, just talk about the issues. Well, first of all, we all as slaves know that Jackson and Sharpton are not really working in our interests. They're Democrats who are facilitators within the imperial order themselves. But could you really talk about Tulia, Texas? Or Jenna 6, or the Sean Bell case, and explain it out in detail without dealing with the racial component? But see, this is the game that hypocrites like Bennett want you to play. But to show you how sick this society and its players are, here is the same Bill Bennett a couple of years ago on his radio show, in a conversation with a caller about the issue of abortion.
An inability of the government to fund Social Security
And I was curious, and I've read articles in recent months here that, you know, the abortions that have happened since Roe v. Wade, the lost revenue for the people who have been aborted during that the last 30-something years, you know, could fund Social Security as we know it today. And, what you know, the media does never touches this at all.
Assuming they're all productive citizens?
Assuming that they are. Even if only a portion of them were, it would be an enormous amount of revenue.
Maybe, but we don't know what the cost would be, too. I think, is abortion disproportionately occur among single women?
I don't know the exact statistics, but quite a bit are, yeah.
All right. Well, I mean, I just don't know. I would not argue for the pro-life position based on this, because you don't know. I mean, it cuts both. You know, one of the arguments in this book, Freakonomics, that they make is that the declining crime rate, you know, this they deal with this hypothesis, that one of the reasons crime is down is that abortion is up. Well,
I don't think that statistic is accurate.
Well, I don't think it is either. I don't think it is either because, first of all, I think there's just too much that you don't know. But I do know that it's true that if you wanted to reduce crime, you could, if that were your sole purpose, you could abort every black baby in this country and your crime rate would go down. That would be an impossible, ridiculous, and morally reprehensible thing to do. But your crime rate would go down. So these far-reaching, you know, extensive extrapolations are, I think, tricky.
Now, this just shows you how sick this same Bill Bennett is. Here he is talking about how, you know, patting Barack on the back for not bringing up race. And then here's a guy, this is a right-wing show. The guy is making an argument on why abortion, an argument against abortion, by saying that, look, having abortion hurts the Social Security issue because you're eliminating would-be people from existing who would be workers who would then help increase the overall economics of the society that would help serve and pay into the whole Social Security system. Now, what was Bennett's response? To say, well, one can argue that there is basically a positive that can be argued out of the abortion aspect. And for him, it came down to the issue of an argument put out that there is a reduction of crime by abortion. And for him, how does he define it? That you could reduce crime through abortion by aborting all black babies, and that the crime rate would go down. Now, of course, he says it's impossible and it's ridiculous and all of that type of stuff, but why did he use black people, black babies, in making an argument about crime rate? It's not only black people who quote-unquote commit crime, especially corporate crime. So, in essence, what he was doing is that crime equals class equals race. Crime equals crime equals race equals blackness. That's his equation. It wasn't crime equals class equals the elite. He didn't say abort all white babies, because by that same fanatical notion, that too would also, quote unquote, under his hypothesis, reduce crime. But Bennett is the ultimate type of race card player. He doesn't ever miss an opportunity to try to put out some kind of crazy equation and notion. But he chastised other black people for talking about the social economic situation that black people are in. Yet here he is talking talking this crazy stuff himself. Crime equals race equals black. So it just shows the whole mindset. When Bennett just opposes the pros of abortion versus the cons of abortion. Yet, nevertheless, you can still count on Jesse Jackson, a person that Bennett attacked, while being interviewed again by Amy Goodman about why Jackson supports Barack, even though he is not openly campaigning for Barack.
So you would go out on the campaign trail for Barack Obama if he asked you to?
Well, I'd have to discuss that with him. He's not asked me to. That's not an issue for me, frankly. My issue right now is...
Has he asked you not to?
No. And I tell you that I respect the distance he's trying to create for his own strategic purposes, and I accept that.
What is that? Why is that?
I don't know.
Shut up, Jackson. You know. Jackson is playing his own type of race car game, the Negro invisibility. He knows that he has an image in many white people's mind as a person who stirs up the racial issues, even though in reality he is a component of helping suppress the issues of black people. For the people that he truly serves. But in the minds of many people, he's a racial agitator. And, of course, this contradicts with the mulattified Negro version that Obama represents. So, of course, Jackson has to accept a form of invisibility. He has to distance himself. As he himself says, that he respects the distance that Obama is trying to keep for his own strategic purposes, but is so beat down that he says he doesn't know why Obama's doing it. Please. In many ways, Obama has Jackson has kind of outlived his purpose. Obama is the next projection that they are trying to captivate these Negro politicians in as they continue to buy them out more and more and increase their economic corporate dominance. The Negroes that are in these particular offices and who are being triangulated in the Congressional Black Caucuses find themselves being more and more in a position where they themselves are being conditioned not to address on the most basic levels the concerns that the black masses that they pretend in their various districts that they represent. What's also interesting is there was an article that came out January 2nd, 2001. In the Village Voice by Peter Knoll called "Is Jesse for Sale?" It goes something like this. Downcast Wall Street investors who fears have been focused on the slowing economy demand that Reverend Jesse Jackson curtail his blistering attacks on George Bush. These financiers arranged the controversial phone call that Jackson made to the president-select, quote-unquote, shortly after Al Gore conceded the race, key business figures told The Voice. Corporate mongrels contribute heavily to Jackson's Wall Street project, an economic development program intended to persuade New York's financial leaders to steer big business bucks to minority communities and entrepreneurs. Your project is in fact the Wall Street office of Jackson's Rainbow Push Coalition. Quote, these guys on Wall Street aren't Democrats or Republicans. They're capitalists, unquote, says one investor. Quote, when they saw the tide turning, some of Reverend Jackson's top contributors put a call into him, unquote. Jackson did not return voice calls for comment. Even before the U.S. Supreme Court had ruled in favor of Bush on the night of December 12th, Jackson was promising to, quote, take to the streets with a civil rights explosion, quote unquote. Prior to his phone call, Jackson had compared the Supreme Court's ruling to the 1857 Dred Scott decision, in which the court declared that blacks, slave or free, did not have the rights of citizens. After the Supreme Court ruling, Jackson said he rejected Bush as the successor to President Clinton, quote, with every bone in my body and every ounce of moral strength in my soul, unquote. He also said that, quote, to lose by racial targeting is dishonorable, unquote. With Wall Street having factored in a Bush victory, sources in the financial community say it was only a matter of time before major movers and shakers muzzled Jackson and other Gore loyalists, crying thievery. Quote, these contributors told Reverend Jackson, quote, you better hold this down because we won't back you anymore if you are adverse to the new administration in Washington, unquote. A financial insider claims, quote, they said, quote, we certainly can't give you the floor of the New York Stock Exchange and all these other perks if you are out there taking shots at a president we have to lobby to get what we want, unquote. My understanding is that they told Reverend Jackson, quote, you better call Bush, quote unquote. The source adds that one business figure also told Jackson he would call Bush, quote, and tell him to take your call, unquote. On December 14th, Bush took a call from the civil rights leader. They talked about, quote, healing the nation and bringing it together, unquote. According to a Bush aide, Bush offered to meet with Jackson, quote, for further discussions on election reform, unquote. In the aftermath of allegations that black voters were unfairly treated in some Florida voting precincts, the next day, Jackson, appearing on NBC's Today Show, said of Bush, quote, it is his burden to bring some closure to that allegation in some fair and open way, unquote. That Jackson could be pressured by Wall Street investors to scale down his rhetoric intrigued a civil rights leader who, and a close associate, quote, why would Jesse make the call? Why would Bush accept the call, he asked. Without confirming what is exactly what happened, this Jackson supporter adds, quote, there must be somebody who is bigger than both of them to put them together, unquote. Some in the black activist community are steaming over Jackson's phone call. They use words like sellout and race merchant and two-faced to describe the nation's best-known civil rights activists. Let me stop right there. I think you get the point. You have a situation where Jackson, like Bush, are serving certain interests. They know when to jump. They know when to bark. And they know when to heal. Jackson knows when to heal. And the same people that call Jackson, the same people that call Bush, would also call Obama if need be. But the Negro 2.0 that is right on his Negro Camelot vision, I don't think he's going to need to be called. Now let's hear a clip once again and go back to Dyson as he responds to this Jackson clip that we went over. Check out.
Sir Dyson, your response.
Well, Jesse Jackson is one of the greatest freedom fighters in the history of this country, certainly in the 20th century.
and he is an ally and an asset to any campaign. I think when he talked about the strategic distance, that's an acknowledgement and a nod to the kind of burden that Jesse Jackson may carry among the white population of people who potentially could vote for him, the same way that Hillary Clinton has to be very careful in terms of how she uses Bill Clinton, whether you use him as a person to leverage her authority or as a wedge between her and that vote. So that's a calculation that has to be dealt with. I think that Jesse Jackson is an incredible asset, a brilliant politician. Without him, Barack Obama wouldn't exist. At the same time, I think his disappointment, perhaps, in his acknowledgement of that painful lag is a realpolitik of race in American culture. And again, this is part of the very difficult and complex argument made in behalf of a person like Barack Obama, seeking to represent all of America, and at the same time not losing sight of what Mr. Ford has talked about. The issues that are gritty, that make a difference for black people. I happen to believe that a Barack Obama presidency would speak poignantly to those issues, but would not nullify or eradicate the necessity for strategic political intervention on behalf of
those
interests.
Let's get Glenn.
It's not an either or.
Let's get Glenn Ford.
This is just rhetoric. Jesse Jackson, one of the great freedom fighters of the 20th century, it's clear that Jackson is literally in the pockets of Wall Street. But in this game of illusion, by those who want us to operate within this system, they continue to project these myths, these historical and class unrealities, and want you to pretend that your participation within the electoral system is you participating in an advancement for not only yourself, but humankind. Dyson says that without Jackson, Barack would not exist. Now that is true. He's right about that. But it's within the context of what these guys are doing and operating within. And how they are independent, how they are set up as office holders and political figures to neutralize independent black radicalization amongst the masses. This just helps expose how Dyson and others are part of the problem. But let's hear how Ford responds to some of Dyson's rhetoric.
Barack Obama does not carry our burden in addition to other burdens. He, in fact, promises to lift white people as a whole's burden, the burden of having to listen to these very specific and historical black complaints to deal with the legacies of slavery. That is his promise to them. That is what allowed him to amass huge, huge numbers of white votes. And he will amass larger and larger percentages of black votes now that black folks see that white folks will vote for Barack Obama. Finally, there's somebody who has a chance. But he can only do this. He has only pulled this off by these continual assurances to white people that race will be off the table. At least that is the way it is received. It's received by masses of white people. It's even received in that way by hard right ideologues like Bill Bennett and George F. Will, who seems to be fascinated by Barack Obama.
And George Will, just like Bill Bennett, is fascinated with Barack Obama in this so-called post-racial setting, George Will says that Obama, quote, serves as a model for blacks, of black possibilities when they are emancipated from the ideologies of blackness. See, this is this whole game of so-called race fatigue by a nation. And that Obama serves as the racial emancipator for white folks in his ascendancy towards higher office. In other words, behold, the mulatto savior. But here again, Dyson further exposes himself as he responds to Ford comparing Barack with Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell, both Negroes, as we know, who were first to hold certain office positions for the empire. Check this out.
Saying, look, that when you make the argument, first of all, implicitly, that there's a relationship of similarity between Colin Powell, but especially Condoleezza Rice and Barack Obama, I think that's patently unfair. First of all, the ideological matrix from which Barack Obama emerges and the grid that he has attempted to deploy is radically dissimilar to any right-wing interest. That doesn't mean that there's not room for severe and serious critique of any political candidate. I have no investment in these people as deities or demiurges or gods. What is suggested in the real world of politics, however, what Mr. Ford has not yet grappled with is that the alternative to a Barack Obama, or for that matter, for those who are concerned about it, even a Hillary Clinton, the reality is this is the game we're in, this is the game that's being played to limit the scope of African-American intelligence, interest, or political concern to the fact that a president is being put forth who happens to be a black man versus the interests of African-American people. I would not be so naive as to assume that the presidency of a Barack Obama would in any way mitigate against or militate against the vast region of problems that black people face. That would call for a kind of political naivete that you should be suspected from the beginning. I'm suggesting is that African-American people have the ability to understand his presidency at the same time, deal with these persistent issues, and Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, and other strategic interventions need to be made by those people as well as the Barack Obama
presidency. Let me play a clip of what
But Dr. Dyson doesn't seem to know what a right-wing interest is. An expanded U.S. military, 100,000 new troops, isn't a right-wing interest. An expanded military budget that sucks up all of the money for health care, for revitalization of the cities, for a rebuilding of America's infrastructure, for all the projects that black folks hold dear, all of which would go down the tubes, would be postponed indefinitely with the kind of expanded military budget that clearly follows from Barack Obama's proposal for 100,000 new troops. So it is not in black folks' interest. It's really not in anyone's interest, of course, but it is diametrically opposed to the historic black political consensus on domestic development to be proposing expanded military activities and budgets.
We only have 30 seconds, Michael Eric Dyson, your response.
Well, listen here. I think that is a legitimate comment to be made in terms of the critique of a potential Barack Obama presidency. Let's see it get here first. I think that a Barack Obama presidency at least holds out the possibility of engaging these forms of critique, engaging the form of the black political consensus about which Mr. Ford has spoken, but also to deal with the fact that we have to be bifocal. The presidency, the people who are making critiques of the system, if he's part of the system, he will be critiqued legitimately, and African-American people will be able to enjoy the victory of the grassroots being able to speak while at the same time being part of a political process that includes us in a very serious way.
We're going to have to leave it there, but this is part one of this debate.
Dyson is doing a whole lot of shucking and jiving in that conversation. I mean, it's incredible. But, you know, when he says that comparing Barack to Condoleezza Rice is unfair. and goes into this because the ideological matrix that Barack emerges in the grid he attempts to deploy diverges from right-wing interests. How does it diverge? Obama picked Lieberman as his mentor, one of the most right-wing ideologues in all of office today. Obama, as we've gone over, has imperial strategist Brzezinski on his side. Here's a conversation that the imperial grand chessboard strategist Brzezinski said in a 1998 interview on the CIA's role in support and basically creation of the Mujahideen. Brzezinski, as I stated before, was a national security advisor to President Jimmy Carter. Brzezinski, quote, according to the official version of history, CIA aid to the Mujahideen began during 1980. That is to say, after the Soviet Army invaded Afghanistan on the 24th of December 1979. But the reality, secretly guarded until now, is completely otherwise. Indeed, it was July 3rd, 1979, that President Carter signed the first directive for secret aid to the opponents of the pro-Soviet regime in Kabul. And that very day, I wrote a note to the president in which I explained to him that, in my opinion, this aid was going to induce a Soviet military intervention. The questionnaire says, well, despite this risk, you were an advocate of this covert action, but perhaps you yourself desired this Soviet entry into war and looked to provoke it? Brzezinski, well, it isn't quite that. We didn't push the Russians to intervene, but we knowingly increased the probability that they would. Question. When the Soviets justified their intervention by asserting that they intended to fight against a secret involvement of the United States in Afghanistan, people didn't believe them. However, there was a basis of truth. You don't regret anything today? Brzezinski. Regret what? That secret operation was an excellent idea. It had the effect of drawing the Russians into the Afghan trap. And you want me to regret it? The day the Soviets officially crossed the border, I wrote President Carter, we now have the opportunity of giving the USSR its Vietnam War. Indeed, for almost 10 years, Moscow had to carry on a war unsupportable by the government, a conflict that brought about the demoralization and finally the breakup of the Soviet Empire. Question. And neither do you regret having supported the Islamic fundamentalism, having given arms and advice to future terrorists? Brzezinski, what is most important to the history of the world? The Taliban or the collapse of the Soviet Empire? Some stirred up Muslims or the liberation of Central Europe and the end of the Cold War? Unquote.